This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this first show of the month of October, October 7th, 2023. And as many of you are aware, October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we see a lot more people wearing pink, and we see a lot more displays to really support those who are in the midst of and have gone through this battle with breast cancer. So this month, and we decided to get out in front of it. Usually we try to get somebody on at some point during the month, but I decided to get out in front. So with that, my guest is going to be Dr. Lisa Atterbury. Dr. Atterbury is a fellowship-trained breast surgical oncologist and a breast reconstruction specialist. And she's from St. Francis. Actually, she is from Trinity Health of New England and practices in the Waterbury area. So she'll be with us in the second half of today's program. In the first half, at about 11:15, we're going to have Dr. William Rabatai. Dr. Rabatai is a regional chief of primary care for Trinity Health of New England, and he's an internist, and he's going to talk to us about the new access center that has opened in Bloomfield. Now, that's a key word, access center, because so many of our listeners get in touch with me because of difficulty finding a primary care physician who they can follow up with and see regularly, and instead are getting their care kind of piecemeal by, you know, going into an urgent care center or an emergency department when they're feeling ill. So Dr. Rabatai is going to talk to us a little bit about what's available at this new access center. It's a beautiful facility. I pass it regularly in my travels, so I'm looking forward to chatting with him. So COVID vaccine availability. We've been talking about it for the last several weeks, mainly about my own struggles, right? So if you'll remember, I originally had an appointment, and that got canceled because they didn't have medication. It wasn't going to be available. Okay. I rescheduled later that week, went to the appointment, and was told they didn't have it. This was at Walgreens. So I scratched that plan, made an appointment with CVS. So I was notified last Saturday that my appointment at CVS was canceled for Monday because they didn't have the vaccine. But I went online and found another CVS in Canton, and they did have it and gave me an appointment for Sunday. So bottom line here is they changed distributors. So from going from one distributor, that being the federal government, they have now gone to multiple distributors, and these shipments are not necessarily getting to the pharmacies. One place they're definitely not getting is hospitals, because none of our employees, whether at UConn, Hartford Health, or Yale, have gotten vaccine through the hospital. So you really have to persist if you want this vaccine. It's out there. You just have to find that pocket or that pharmacy that may have it. I got it. Now, one of the questions that's come up, Will had a question for me during the week, and that was about whether to get both vaccines together or get them in the same arm. So let me give you what I believe is the best course of action, and we've had this discussion with Dr. David Banik as well. Getting the flu shot and the COVID vaccine at the same time is convenient. It's not necessary. You can do it at two separate visits, but if you wish to, there's no harm in doing that. They typically do it in each arm. They don't do it in the same arm. I had gotten my flu shot earlier at UConn as part of my job, so I only got the COVID vaccine this time. So there's no real interaction that we need to worry about. But when we talk a little bit about the RSV vaccine, now RSV vaccine has some limitations in the sense of they're only recommending it for people over 60, people with chronic lung and heart disease, pregnant women beyond 32 weeks of their pregnancy, and people with immunosuppression. So with the RSV vaccine, we don't know a lot about giving that vaccine with others at the same time. So many people are saying, wait a month, then go get the RSV vaccination. But some people might have to get all three at the same time, and there's no harm in doing that that we know of. So I hope that answers your question, Will, that you had about that. What's also interesting is that the Nobel Peace Prize for Medicine was given out this week, and it was given out to two of the instrumental scientists who created the RNA messenger vaccine and that model. And it's interesting because they one is a Hungarian-American as well as another American who met really coincidentally at a meeting and started doing work together over the years. This is not something that happened, you know, in a flash. A lot of people will say, wow, they just came up with this whole messenger RNA thing. They have been working on this for many, many years in different countries and with other scientists. But they are the people that really put this together and, you know, really were the key item, was the key item in stopping the pandemic as we know it. There are some people who are epidemiologists who are speculating that from when we started in 2020, if we had not had a vaccine, we might be just getting out of the pandemic. Right? So the people said, don't take the vaccine, just let it run its course. Okay, so October 2023, we just start seeing the numbers come down. And it's at a manageable level, but everybody knows somebody now who has COVID. I mean, it's out there, it's rampant. And we know that because we measure the titers in wastewater at the sewerage plants. So we know that it's rising here in Connecticut. There are more people getting COVID. And we need to start being somewhat cautious about who we're around and when to wear masks. I continue to ask my patients to wear a mask when they're in the clinic because they are now around other patients. And when we're in the exam room for an extended period of time, we wear masks. And I think that's the safest thing to do for everybody right now. And there are plenty of masks available. It's not like when this first started where every seamstress was making cloth masks similar to 1918. Another thing that came out this week was the use of Ozempic and Wegovy. Now, these are those medications that were designed for type 2 diabetes. They're injectable medications. But they've also been found to have a tremendous benefit to people who are obese and in getting them to lose weight. And it's held a lot of advantages in terms of congestive heart failure and things such as that. But you have to understand that there are some risks to doing it. It works as a means of slowing digestion. So it slows how food and nutrition moves through the intestinal system, something called gastroparesis. The risk here is that people have developed pancreatitis, bowel obstruction, and absolute paralysis of how the muscles in their stomach coordinate and move. Constipation is a pretty well-known risk factor or side effect to using these medications. So how do you get around it? These drugs have tremendous benefit. So the key thing is to only take these medications under a doctor's direction. And what you need to do is gradually move up in terms of the dosage you're taking. So with that, you just gradually titrate things up and go from there. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. William Rabatai, and we're going to be talking about the new Access Center from Trinity Health of New England that's here in Bloomfield, Connecticut. If you wish to reach me during the program, just shoot me an email at info@alessimd.com. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. It's great to be with you this Saturday morning and to welcome my first guest, Dr. William Rabatai. Dr. Rabatai is Associate Regional Chief of Primary Care for Trinity Health of New England. He's a specialist in internal medicine and leads the charge here at the Bloomfield Access Center. The new Access Center, for those of you unfamiliar, is on Cottage Grove Road at 852 Cottage Grove Road here in Bloomfield, Connecticut. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Thanks so much for having me.
So tell us about the new Access Center and some of the services there and what people can expect if they need care there.
Yeah, sure. So we've been open since mid-August, and we have a bunch of services available. So I am a primary care provider, and I and two colleagues currently see patients there for primary care, Dr. Michael Gray and a nurse practitioner, Mary Marlowe. And we're about to welcome two new providers in the next 2 months. Both doctors, one of them from relocating from California, but he actually trained here at UConn. And the other is Dr. Preisner, who's now gotten remarried, and her last name is Dr. Rickman. And she'll be coming in the next couple of weeks. So we're very excited to be able to offer a lot more primary care for Bloomfield because we know that finding a PCP in the area can be tough. But in addition to that, we have cardiology, urology, vascular surgery, infusions, general surgery. So the whole idea of an access center is to try and kind of provide this one-stop shopping for different services so people don't have to run all over town. We have a lab, and then we have a urgent care right next door.
Okay. You know, it's interesting because I see a lot of growth here in Bloomfield. We've got a lot of, I guess you'd call them almost luxury apartments going up for people to rent. And so I could see where the need is rising for people to get access to health care. With our urgent care, how often is that open? How often are you guys open for services at the Access Center? You open on weekends as well? I never know anymore in medicine.
So. So the urgent care is an affiliated partner with Trinity, but it's actually run by Premier Urgent Care. So the great thing about it is that we will have a very close connection with them, and we will share a electronic medical record, so it'll be a very seamless transition. But I don't actually oversee the urgent care specifically. The hours are certainly more extended than the primary care hours, and there are weekend hours available as well.
How about radiology? Can people get scans there, MRIs, anything of that nature, mammography?
Yeah, so in the urgent care side, if you do have, something that requires a, some sort of an X-ray, or, if you sprained your wrist and they need to make sure it's not broken, they can do that on file, on site there. But we do not have general radiology services at the Ambulatory Access Center. We do have a blood lab, though.
Oh, okay. That was my next question. So you jumped on that. So you can get the full array of blood tests. If you have a blood slip, you can go there.
Correct.
So you can see how old I am when I say blood slip. Nobody has a slip anymore. So
it's very true. Very true.
How about surgery from the standpoint of outpatient minor surgeries? Do you do that there as well?
Not on site. We do infusions. So if you, we do a specific type of infusions, specifically more for multiple sclerosis. But we don't do, but we don't do day surgeries there.
What's the most popular service that people seem to demand in the area when you open an urgent care, when you open, you know, a regional access center? What's the thing most people seem to need?
You know, it actually varies. It's hard for me to pinpoint one specific thing that everybody, you know, everybody has such a wide array of needs in healthcare. So, you know, what I find is when I see a new patient, they say, oh my gosh, I haven't found a new PCP in so long. It's so hard to find a new PCP. And then other people are like, oh, it's so great that there's a lab here. You know, we've been kind of waiting for a lab to be here. And then other people are like, wow, it's great that we have urology and we don't have to go into the hospital to see a urologist anymore. So there's a lot of different things that different people will kind of report. If you look to see kind of like what people are really kind of craving, it's really the convenience of not needing to go into a hospital setting to receive a lot of care.
And get parking.
And the parking is great.
No,
yes,
it's really. I find the same thing. And in looking at the facility, I said, "Wow!" I mean, the first thing you see is there's plenty of parking, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have a coffee shop. You have a Starbucks attached to it. So, mm-hmm. I think the convenience. I agree with you that the convenience of it all. So, in talking
from my
about
perspective.
This,
I just wish there was a dry cleaners on site. That would complete my convenience factor.
So when we talk about expanding outpatient services in general, not just mm-hmm. the access center, where is the movement going toward, from your estimation, in terms of, you know, what's the next thing we're going to see in terms of moving towards more outpatient care?
That's a loaded question. So you're definitely seeing a lot more of a push to do things outside of an acute care setting. That's coming from a lot of different factors. So you've got patients, like I said, that don't really want to go into the hospital anymore if they can avoid it. And then you have insurance companies, they're kind of pushing more for things to be done in less acute care settings because of costs and things like that. But I think another huge factor for the future of healthcare is going to be virtual services and what things can be done coordinated electronically or with patients actually not even needing to leave their home.
Okay. I think that really shows a lot. Do you think... are we still getting paid for video services and calls like that? I mean, I could see where they're more convenient in terms of efficiency and time, but there was some controversy over whether insurance companies were going to reimburse for that.
Yeah. So we don't have the parity that we did with the healthcare emergency. Where if you did a synchronized virtual visit, where if the patient could see you and you could see them, like a Skype call, then that was basically paid out at the exact same rate as a in-person call during the COVID pandemic. But now you're seeing kind of insurance companies walk that back. They still offer it, though, and it is still a service that can be utilized and reimbursed. What we're seeing a very large walk back on is the telephone-only visits. So there was an element where, and it's true, patients sometimes have difficulty accessing, you know, not everybody has Wi-Fi, not everybody has a cell phone that can communicate in real time. And so then in those cases, we did kind of revert back to just a telephone phone call where you would do a lot of the visit. And so it's not just a simple phone call. And you're seeing that those kind of services are being cut back by insurance companies. They want either that virtual, synchronized virtual visit or an in-person visit. And I will say that patients, you would think that they would kind of crave that convenience, and some people really do, but there is a large element of that human touch that patients, I feel, really are still looking for. And so a lot of patients actually prefer to come in.
I think you're right on that for sure. One thing, though, I guess this is kind of a loaded question as well, but I know that since you straddle the administrative and the clinical, and you'll have some idea of this, and that is physicians are always getting messages now, right? So we get email messages, we get my chart messages, we have to return phone calls. And, you know, some patients say, well, why can't they just give me a call? Why do they have to schedule a time with me to talk on the telephone? And I've always found that the problem is you've finished your workday, you've finished doing all your dictations, and now you've got to make these phone calls. How have you gotten around this for your physicians in terms of being able to have sufficient amount of time to take care of these other services? Because they do take time, especially the MyChart messages have kind of exploded with that convenience.
Yeah, so that's definitely a work in process, and we are, trying to kind of stay ahead of that. Physicians are burning out all over the country because of a lot of expectations from a lot of different angles. At Trinity, we do have, administrative time as part of our 40-hour work week, so patients are not seen for a certain proportion of time, and the ability to kind of have time to call people back and to do those non-face-to-face clinical tasks. But oftentimes it's not enough. And so we're hoping that the future of healthcare is also going to be more of like a shared savings, where instead of physicians being reimbursed just because a patient is seen, but also reimbursed because of outcomes. Yep. So that would allow less patients to need to be seen during the day and more time and kind of wraparound services, if that makes sense. So physicians aren't necessarily paid to see patients, but to actually make sure that their total care is taken care of. I don't know if that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
Yeah.
But just because it makes sense doesn't mean the system will do it.
Exactly.
But I'm glad you're doing it at Trinity Health. Bill, listen, thank you for your time. And again, the Bloomfield Access Center is open. The phone number there, 860-714-2990, if you want access, if you need primary care help. Bill, thanks again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Yep.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my next guest, Dr. Lisa Atterbury, and we're going to be talking about breast cancer. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And it's great to be with you on this Saturday morning, October 7th. And we're chatting with my guest today because this month is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And Dr. Lisa Atterbury is a fellowship-trained breast surgical oncologist and breast reconstruction specialist. She practices with Trinity Health of New England, and her office is in Southbury, Connecticut, and she's been kind enough to join us today. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm happy to be on it, and especially for Breast Cancer Awareness Month.
So let's talk a little bit about breast cancer. Where are we? Are we winning the fight?
I think we are. We have a long way to go. I think there's been major advances with molecular DNA mapping. That's really changed how we treat these patients. And you're kind of seeing the gamut switch from a lethal disease, and it still is in some certain sense, but a lot of people are living with metastatic breast cancer just like they would diabetes or hypertension, because our treatment modalities have gotten so much better, as our diagnostic as well.
Really? I mean, that even surprises me in terms of metastatic disease. Now, let's talk about the types of breast cancer and how, because I always think about, you know, the people who have survived are because it's localized to the breast only, didn't go to lymph nodes and things such as that. So can you please educate us all, including me, about how we're dealing with all the different types?
So look, that's a loaded question, Tony. So if you break it down, 60-80% of cancers are ductal in origin, just because okay. that's the major anatomy of the breast. You have about 10-15% are lobular, and then you have outliers, Paget's disease, inflammatory, other things. But when you get to the subsets, each breast cancer has its own unique DNA. You know, where there's certain things that we test for, whether a tumor is sensitive to estrogen or not. And now with more molecular mapping, which is really the DNA of the tumor. So we were always used to, as physicians, is testing our DNA, right, to see if we're carriers of whatever it may be, Turner syndrome, sure. all that. Now we can take tumors, not all of them, but a lot of them, and look at a DNA panel, and it'll really tell us, you know, what is their risk of recurrence? Is it an aggressive disease? And if it is, what is the benefit for these individuals of taking chemo, of decreasing their risk of recurrence? What is the benefit for the hormones? So we're really starting to individualize these treatments. And yes, localized disease now is just defined to the axillary lymph nodes. You can have patients with disease in their bones that live 20, 30 years. You know, we've seen patients that have had metastatic disease that, you know, their survival at 5 years used to be 10%. Now we're starting to see that get 20%. And I think we're seeing less of those. We do see those, but we're seeing less because of this type of talk show or people getting out and getting their studies, it just making people more well. So we're diagnosing a lot earlier. And we now know, believe it or not, we're over-treating. So now we're trying to change the gamut of not only targeting the treatment, which will allow a longer disease-free survival, but not over-treating these patients, which happened in the past with, you know, chemotherapy was always the standard, and now it's changing. Molecular therapy, Keytruda, Verzenio, all these new immunotherapies are really just changing the game.
I'm so glad you brought this up, because I'm a big fan of personalized medicine and knowing the DNA and knowing the specifics about your tumor. So, and let's look at, with immunotherapy, for people listening, do they still have the same side effects as the what we would call traditional chemotherapy? Because people, when they hear the word chemotherapy, I saw a patient this week, and she had breast cancer. She's been going through this battle, and she had pretty much localized disease, no lymph nodes, but her doctor said she'd have to have chemotherapy and radiation. She suggested chemotherapy and radiation, and she said, I'm just not doing the chemotherapy. And I said, why? And she said, listen, I don't want to go through that. I don't want my hair falling out. I don't want all these other side effects. With immunotherapy, are you still seeing those same side effects that we would see with traditional chemotherapy?
We are not. We are definitely not. You know, the traditional chemotherapy and your patient, it's hard to say what type of disease she had. But,
sure.
You know, chemotherapy is really good at killing cells that are rapidly dividing or growing, which are cancer cells. However, it attacks healthy cells. So it kind of takes everyone when it goes into the body. Now with the immunotherapy, if you look at Keytruda has been out for quite a while. You know, they don't have the same side effects. They're very targeted therapy, and there are probably people walking around you right now that are on Keytruda, Kadcyla, any of those medications with no side effects. It's very targeted down to the molecular level of these tumors. And so instead of being, you know, hitting everything, you know, the hair loss, right? They get the burns in the mouth kind of component.
Sure.
They get the peripheral neuropathy, as you know, personally.
That's what I see them for, right.
Yeah, the peripheral neuropathy from the platinums, absolutely, and the taxanes. We don't see that. I mean, they're walking around, and, you know, I have a patient right now who just saw me. She has a local recurrence after 1 year. She's in her late 70s, a little frail, but started Ibrance and has been on it for 2 months, and she's going about her normal life like nothing. Now, there are some people that if you read the literature, there's always somebody, right, Tony? There's, you know, an instance of colitis. You know, if you look at aspirin, you know, aspirin should probably a black box warning now with all the side effects. But We don't see that now with these medications. It really has flipped. You know, we've taken a lot from the autoimmune community, and now, you know, translating it over into cancers and, you know, lung cancer, melanoma, breast cancer, you know, prostate, they're doing molecular mapping, colon as well. So you really have to change that mindset of people think of chemotherapy of, you know, that person who's a skeleton, they can't eat, they have hair loss, you know, they look like they're almost on the deathbed. And honestly, sometimes with chemo, that's how it goes. It doesn't look good. Very different picture now, as you see.
Let's shift over. You mentioned about prevention and people going out and getting their studies. And typically, I think that means mammography. And we are constantly going through this, I don't know, revolt about when to get mammography, when the USPSTF tell us. And the New England Journal of Medicine just published a perspective of a dissenting view. So It's confusing for physicians. It's got to be confusing for the public. Can you give us your perspective on when should women be getting mammograms?
Absolutely. So that is definitely a moving target. In the mid 2015, 2016, there was a government study that came out and said, you know, every other year for mammograms starting at 45, well, we saw a huge escalation of missed breast cancers. Right. So the American Society of Breast Surgeons in 2019 put out a statement, which American Cancer Society just kind of adopted part of it, saying, really with no risk factors, nobody, family history, you haven't been deemed to be high risk. 40 is your time to get your mammogram. And it's yearly thereafter, unless your life expectancy drops to less than 10 years. So that's kind of where we sit. The American Cancer Society just came out with a statement of saying, well, every year till 50 and then every other year. And that's, you don't want to be in that situation because the most common age of diagnosis for a female is 62. So women are 62 and men are 71. You know, everybody thinks it's always these young people, like it's 30s, and they're a small subset. They just get a lot of publicity. But really, 62 is the average age. And so the American Society of Breast Surgeons, which, you know, for myself is what we follow, is really it's 40 every year, you know, unless something dramatically changes. You know, if I have somebody who's, I might have a patient who's 80 years of age and she's healthier than a 50-year-old, then I'm like, keep getting your mammograms. So that's kind of where we sit for all comers. Now, when you have high risk, that gets a little bit different. Are they genetically? Do they carry a genetic mutation? You know, then some of the recommendations are starting MRIs at the age of 25 because mammograms aren't great for that subset of population because of their dense breast tissue. Now, if you just have somebody who's high risk, you know, maybe a mother had breast cancer, their aunt, their father, you know, men get breast cancer as well. You know, that may put them in a high risk category where we alternate a mammogram and MRI every 6 months to follow them. So that's where we kind of sit on the basics. It can get a little bit different based on the mutations that they have, but really 40 is our recommendation, unless something changes, family history, their personal history, yearly thereafter, unless, you know, they do have a life expectancy, all of a sudden it becomes less than 10 years. And that's a consideration. That's also a conversation to have with the patient as well, you know, and so it's not like a mandate. I don't think anybody can mandate that. We have these conversations every day, but that's where the American Society of Breast Surgeons sits. I think that's a very good policy given the fact that the average age is 62.
Let's get into surgery. What are the types of surgery? I remember as a medical student way back in the 70s that we were dealing with radical mastectomies that were huge operations done. Obviously, things have changed a lot since that time. So can you talk a little bit about the surgical options for someone with breast cancer? And I know there's a wide array of them. So if you can help us with that.
I'll try my best. And so up until the 80s, every female had a mastectomy because that was the standard, like you said, the Halsted.
Yep.
In the late 80s, they started looking at more breast conservation, meaning a lumpectomy. And through studies, they determined that a lumpectomy with radiation is equal in survival to a mastectomy. So the only true benefit for a mastectomy, and that holds through today, is really risk reduction. So you have those coming now where breast conservation, mastectomy. So if you start with mastectomies, you know, the Halsted mastectomy was horrible. Pectoralis, yep. The chest muscle was gone, the deformities gone, lymphedema, that irreversible swelling, massive. We're now to the point where I think I came out and practiced in 2006. And so we were kind of in Philadelphia. I talked Dr. Tom Frazier, who was my fellowship director. He was kind of pushing. And so I started doing nipple sparing mastectomies. And we took a lot of heat from societies. And now that's the standard. So if you can, you could possibly try to preserve the nipple in doing these mastectomies. And which is a game changer, right? It looks like you've almost just deflated the breast tissue and have that natural skin and nipple areola complex. The risk of recurrence is the exact same of the old mastectomies. So if you can't do nipple sparing, you know, there's other ways to reconstruct. And so with the mastectomies, you know, now since 2017, we're doing direct implants. And it used to be, you know, you do a mastectomy, you know, plus or minus the lymph nodes, and then you would put a tissue expander in, which kind of looks like a flat balloon. You'd put it behind the muscle and slowly expand that pocket to give you, you know, the illusion that there's breast tissue there. And then 8 months later, depending on what the treatment, then they would go back for another procedure and get an implant. Well, everything kind of changed pretty dramatically in 2017, 2018, where it can really be a one-stage procedure in the right environment. So a patient can come in, have mastectomies, direct implants, and this state is a little different. You know, you have the no drive-by mastectomy. That doesn't quite, I've never heard of it until I moved here, but, you know, I would send my patients home after.
I don't even know what that is. So
somewhere in the literature and politically driven, somebody thought that, you know, sending patients home the day of a mastectomy was just, you know, unfair and, you know, cruel. And so in your state, you actually have to keep a patient overnight for a mastectomy, which I've been in practice for 17 years and rarely have I kept a patient overnight. I mean, now they don't really have pain. They go home, they have drains, but most of the time they go home that day and it's a nice one-stage procedure. The challenging part is really getting patients to buy in because there is a 6 to 8 week period where they have to kind of settle down. And so that's really important. Complication rate can be higher, but that's a big changer from that part. When you look at a lumpectomy, really up until like 2018, you know, and when it started, if you had an abnormal mammogram and you had a biopsy, there was a clip left in there if there was not a palpable lesion. So their surgery, if you would test the lymph nodes, and so, Tony, I know you're aware, but, you know, underneath the arm, there's 30 to 40 lymph nodes. We really yep. target the sentinel nodes. So the sentinel nodes, I always say, are just the gatekeepers are the first lymph nodes that are going to receive infection or cancer. So we want to keep that dissection less than 4. And so up until 2019, the way it would go would, if you were doing a lumpectomy, the patient would come into the hospital, they would check in, they would have to go to radiology. And then while they're awake, there's a guide wire, a wire put into their breast down to that clip. Not the most comfortable thing. And then while they were down there, they would go to radiology, nuclear med, and get a radionucleotide injected to help us identify the lymph nodes. Then they would come up to surgery. There's a chance of that needle being dislodged. So you get that all together. You take it back to the operating room. You know, we inject like a blue dye. And so you would take these lymph nodes out based on the radioactive count, which, as you and I both know, radioactive is not great. Who knows what's going to be, what we're going to be like in 30 years. But not only that, is that guide wire would shift all over the place. So it was a truly traumatic experience for these patients. It's a 4-hour delay for a surgeon and an OR, but more importantly, the patients hated it. So in 2018, Centamag, which is by Ethicon, I happened to meet the right person at the right time where we were able to get rid of all that. And so I can do a biopsy in the office. I can drop a mag seed, which is just a tiny magnet. It is about 4, a grain of salt.
Is this the MagTrace technology?
This is. Yep, this is part of the MagTrace. The MagTrace is the liquid magnet we inject instead of the radionucleotide. So that can be injected in the office. Wow. Or pre-op. So you have this little, it's basically all magnetic. That's ionized mag. That's all it is. So you can either inject it if you drop that mag seed in the office, or that will stay for almost, you can, depending on the literature, you can probably do it almost 9 months out of seeing it. So if someone has to go through chemo, you can still find that place where the cancer was. So they patients now come in and they don't have an idea now unless I've had a patient who's had a needle look and pass. And that's the first thing they kind of hit me with. Like, I hated the wire. It was painful. I didn't want to do it. And so Now you drop these in there, you know, you numb up the breast, you drop the mag seed in there, and the pre-op area in your office, you numb up the breast and liquid magnet, the mag tracer. You go right to the operating room. You have a probe that helps you identify specifically underneath the arm. The sensitivity and specificity for the mag tracer identifying lymph nodes is about 97% to 98%. Pretty accurate. Small little incision. Yeah, we like to keep the lymph nodes to less than 4 to treat that lymphedema rate very, very low. And then you can put the probe right on the breast while the patient's asleep, target down. You can use an ultrasound, remove that lesion, and you're done and over. And so patients are not traumatized. They're not, you know, traveling across the street, which happens in many areas, you know.
Sure.
It's a game changer. And honestly, from the 80s when it started, Tony, this has really been the first major advance in partial, you know, breast conservation and trying to get that to be standard so that everyone can experience it. So we've been able to bring that to St. Mary's. And patients, I mean, my patients have been using it since 2019. They love it. You know, when they hear about this guide wire, they think it's barbaric. And in my mind, it is barbaric. So the direct implants, the mag tracer, mag seed, Centimag, those are really big game changers of, you know, keeping individuals' quality of life moving, keeping the trauma less. You know, breast cancer isn't like a physical emergency, but it is a mental emergency. And, you know, it's very high profile. So the less trauma you can give the patient, the better. And getting them back to a normal life, it's a total game changer with it.
Breast reconstruction has obviously become very popular now. And I think you're saying in some cases you do the reconstruction at the same time as the mastectomy or the lumpectomy.
You can do both. If you do a lumpectomy, if someone's very large-breasted, they may opt for breast reduction at the same time. You know, the radiation oncologist would Sure. proceed on. So sometimes you have defects from taking out breast tissue that, you know, it's called oncoplastics, where you can move some tissue around. But yes, if patients are doing mastectomy and they're the right candidate, you know, they're not a smoker, you know, they're going to be compliant, absolutely. You can do mastectomies at that stage and put the implants in. And the implants are wrapped in a special type of mesh. It's a cadaver mesh, believe it or not. You could drop it in dirt and it will not become infected. The military has been using it for 20 years. You kind of wrap that implant in it, you put it in that pocket, and they go home one stage. I mean, it's a huge change versus, you know, these 6 months of tissue expanders or, you know, the whole trauma of it. You know, before they had such pain because you were putting the implants or the expanders behind the muscle. Patients hated you, which was kind of sure. good because they were behaving. But now they go home and they have no pain, which is now the challenge, right? You know, patients with no pain, they like, I'll just go out and pick up my kids or so.
Yep.
Yeah, but they can do it one stage, which is, you know, it's a great option to have for those select
Tremendous.
Patients.
Tremendous. Mm-hmm. Lisa, I want to thank you. Thank you for your time today. And really thank you for all you do for women with breast cancer and I should say men, although a minority
yes.
group. With breast cancer. For people who wish to get in touch with Dr. Atterbury, the phone number is area code 203-709-8662, and she's in Southbury. Lisa, thanks again for your time.
All right, Tony, you too. Take care. It was a pleasure.
Take care. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. Back on Healthy Rounds, I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Bill Robitaille and Dr. Lisa Atterbury. Many thanks to our studio producer, Kevin Kors, has been on the board. Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. We'll always be taking your calls and emails at info@alessimd.com. If you missed any part of today's show, you can get the Healthy Rounds podcast wherever you download your podcasts. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.